Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Johanna Arneson. I'm an assistant professor at the Umeå University, working with media and cultural studies.
And it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today. My first question is to ask what the things are that are currently preoccupying, worrying, dynamizing, interesting, obsessing you.
Yeah, I think the last couple of weeks, my life has been sort of circling around getting a book manuscript to the publisher. I've been editing a research anthology with, at least for now, the tentative title is Influencer Politics. And it's about, well, social media influencers and politics, mostly in the Nordic countries, but also other examples from Germany and Ukraine and so on. So that's been my main focus for the last couple of weeks to get that done and to get it to the publisher. But I've also, on a more personal level, I've taken up knitting again. Haven't done that for 15 years at least, and it has sort of taken over my life. So yeah, I'm knitting, and I'm listening to podcasts nowadays.
And can you tell us why you stopped knitting 15 years ago?
Oh, I don't know. It just I think I never I only, I learned the basics, and then I could only make scarves. And you can only make so many scarves. And then it becomes a bit boring for, well, for me and for all the people around me who only got scarves. But now I've learned how to make, what's it called? Mittens. I know how to make a
Mittens.
thumb for a mitten now. So now I can make mittens.
I'm just putting up two thumbs
Yeah.
in support of you in celebration. That's
Yeah.
exciting.
So I thought, I think I stopped because I got a bit bored with the scarves, and I did a lot of cross stitch embroidery
Oh,
for a long while back then. So that was my main craft then.
And what's taken you back to knitting?
I had to do something with my hands. Working in academia, it's so much. You work with your head a lot. And I wanted to do something practical, and I like crafting. I've tried the different, versions of not just the textile, but also like wood carving and stuff like that. And I like to do something with my hands. And as I said, for me, it's been the cross stitching has been like something that I've been doing for a lot. Longer time. But that is, embroidery is very, it's pretty and it can be provoking and it can be all of those things, but it's not very practical.
Practical, practical. So how did
Yeah.
you
So the
do?
knitting, that makes it, then you make stuff like mittens or a sweater or a scarf or whatever that you can actually use.
And tell me how you learned about making the thumb for the mitten. Is this YouTube?
Yes, it's YouTube. I tried reading the instructions, but I don't understand them.
When you
So,
see somebody do it physically, it
yeah,
helps, right?
it really helps.
I guess this
And
is one of the
actually, a lot of these like knitting, when you buy, if you buy patterns online and so on, they often come with a link to a YouTube channel or to instruction videos.
I wonder what that does to the tradition, often in gendered terms, of mothers passing down knitting skills to daughters.
Yeah, in a way, it
Interesting.
becomes more individualized because you can sit at home and learn by yourself. And you don't, I mean, of course, there is some kind of community there because you might become part of the knitting community online and you get to know people and you get to know pattern makers and maybe follow them and so on. But it's not that, one to one or one to a few. interactions when you have this, like a knitting circle or whatever.
Well,
So.
that's interesting. Well, I look forward to seeing, perhaps on our next podcast, a completed mitten. Maybe they'll just be one. Maybe they'll just be two thumbs of two mittens. I
Yes.
don't
I will
know.
only make thumbs. That's
I'm
some kind of statement.
the thumb professor. I love
Yeah.
it. And in terms of the other work you mentioned, the editing work, what's it been like editing academics? I'm assuming these are mostly professors. Are they
Yeah.
easy to herd, easy to rule, or are
No.
they so individualistic and bourgeois that they're impossible?
I refer to this process as trial and terror, because it's my first time also editing a book like this, and having that kind of that position and that responsibility, and I had no idea about what the process would look like. And it's also my experience from writing chapters for like an anthology and so on has been pretty different, because those times there's my perception at least has been that there has been not just the academic editors but also an editor from the publisher who has been involved in the project in some way. I mean, not of course as much as the actual editors, but there has been a presence of the publisher, and well, that might not be my experience from this process as much, but it's been fun, and it's been frustrating, and it's been, up and down, and trying to, herd these kittens of academics, getting people to actually, send in their drafts and their texts by the deadline, or get also. We had to me and I, it's not just me actually. I have a co-editor also, Hanna Reinikainen, who's at University of Helsinki, and we organized, the peer review process ourselves and so on. And that was also, a first time for me having to reach out to people that I may or may not know that well and ask them for a favor. Can you please do this? And so on. So it's been, yeah. It's been interesting and stressful at some parts. And also, I think I learned a lot. So next time I know some that I would do, some things that I would do different. Yeah.
And it's in English.
It's in English. And
So,
it's going to be open access.
oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So, for many people, probably most, English will be a second or third language, most of the contributors.
Yeah.
And they may have learned English in quite different ways from one another, I imagine. So, that's another issue often when people are having to write in a second or third language, and they may have encountered it in traditions that are not identical. In particular.
Yeah.
But wonderful that it'll be open access. How did you
Yeah.
find the authors? How did you recruit them?
I reached out to them because I had some names that I knew. I got actually the whole process started and I was approached by an editor at for the publisher, and then we talked about could this, like, he had looked at some of my previous work and he wondered if I was interested in writing a book on this topic of influencers and politics. And we discussed it. And I said, I think an anthology would be better to get more perspectives and voices and so on. So we sent a proposal to the publisher and they said, okay, after a while. And then, oh, actually, I think, yeah, I asked most of the contributors, the authors before that. So they were basically people that I knew of who were working within this area, who were interested in these topics. And then they also suggested people. And I did some kind of, strategic overview or online research, trying to find
Mm-hmm.
people in the different Nordic countries also to get a sort of some kind of geographical cover, you know, not
Wonderful.
just Sweden, for example.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about influencers and politics. Not the book, but the topic more generally. Where do we stand with this, if I can use a we?
Well, I mean, I've been researching this for the last couple of years now, and for me, at least, my interest in the topic started with seeing, you know, political conversations online in sort of the influencer on different influencers' platforms and within that community and so on. So my interest started with like influencer culture as a form of public space where, you know, politics happens and is discussed in different ways. And I think that's one of my main sort of arguments why this is interesting, is that it, you know, people might have this conception of influencer culture as something that is only, you know, that it's trivial. That it's, so you should say, it's only about horses and makeup, and it's not. People are very like the audience, the followers, they're not always, you know, only duped into buying stuff and consumerism and so on. They are also very active and very critical and might, you know, politicize influencers and their content and their commercial collaborations and so on. So that was the start for me. But I think it's also, at least in Sweden, we've seen this, and in many other countries also, that like a more general discussion on influencers and their role in, well, in politics in general, maybe connected to elections, for example, like the influencer as both sort of, this is actually what my chapter in the upcoming book is a bit about, but the influencer as some sort of savior of democracy, that this is a way for political actors, for parties, for example, to reach a younger audience, the audience that doesn't really, you know, maybe read traditional newspapers or watch TV and so on. And that influencers are then a way to reach and engage this audience, make them either for your own purposes, if you're a political party or something like that, but also maybe to just make them interested in politics, make them go and vote and so on. And there is this idea of influencers that they have this connection. They have this big audience, which makes them then important, and they have this connection with the audience that they can present politics in a way that appeals to predominantly then the
Yes.
younger people. But then there's also this more negative view on influencers as a threat to democracy. Basically, because of the same thing, that it becomes simplified, it becomes commercialized, it becomes, you know, up for grabs for anyone who can pay for this influence, you know. And also, at least in the material I've been looking at, you can see the journalists are sort of gatekeeping also their role in the like in the public sphere, that they feel like they are being what's the word? Circumvented, when politicians, for example, rather choose to be interviewed on a YouTuber's channel than to be, you know, interviewed by a proper journalist.
That's interesting. So one of the things about celebrities historically is that there's been a lot of research over many, many years that suggests that in the US context, at least, when they start talking about politics, they lose their cachet. When they're selling something about a lifestyle or a product, they can exert enormous influence over the public. But when they start talking about climate change or gender or a political party, that influence is cut quite drastically. I guess with influencers, it's still a fairly early period of investigation into what impact they can have in these fields. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say so. And it's also a lot about, like, if you're an influencer doing some kind of political influencing, or, it has to be in line with your previous work. It has to be, you cannot just come and say, oh, you should think about the environment, or you should, vote on this party or whatever. If it's not in line with your usual content and the perception that the audience has of you as a person, or and so on, and that is one of the big sort of issues here, I think. And you can also see that like among at least examples of Swedish influencers that I've been looking at, they. Because this is also a matter of professionalization within the industry itself. And there are different ways of looking at this from the influencer perspective, also, because some of them, at least those who have been more like involved in this formal politics, like inviting political parties or party leaders into their doing interviews with them before the election and so on, they often sort of emphasize this more journalistic role. Like, I'm not taking a stand here. I just want my followers to become interested in politics. It's important that they know a little bit about all these political parties and representatives and so on. So they have
So
that.
I'm not being partisan.
No,
That's the
exactly. I'm
message.
just I'm giving you this information.
That's like MTV in the US in the 80s with its get out the vote notion, which is encouraging young people to vote. We don't care which way you do, but we just want you to get involved. With the presumption being that, and this has been decades long and worldwide, that young people are disenchanted with the political process, that they're apathetic, that they're not involved. And this is something that's been was said when I was in high school, but it keeps being discovered as a new truth over and over and over again, right? A way of condemning young people or condemning the system or a bit of both, right?
And the media system
Oh, of course,
also,
yes,
yeah, and
absolutely. And this
journalism that doesn't speak to young people and so on.
exactly. Even though there may be all sorts of forces at play that are not centered around the media that can account for those things, to the extent that they're even true. But all of that said, this is a really important project, especially at this time. It's really important that it's going to be available free to everybody because I can't think of a year when there are so many elections being held around the world and where there is so much collective anxiety about traditional democratic institutions being undermined, and so much about how and why and so on.
I hope it's gonna be like we see it as a contribution to this these discussions that are ongoing in many places right now. And it's one part of the book focuses more on these sort of the formal politics and connections to elections and political parties and so on. But then there's also sort of the politics of influencer culture or in influencer culture that is not necessarily formal politics in that way, but more of the sort of lifestyle politics and sort of politicization of influencers in different ways, both by themselves or others,
And I presume that, as in the capital P political sphere, this takes a form in terms of things like gender and race and age and class and sexuality and all these other forms of defining people. Is that right?
It's a very sort of at least the world of influence, or the sort of influencers that this book is focusing on, is it's a very gendered genre, because it's mostly these sort of lifestyle, fashion, makeup influencers. So at least the gender, and for me also the class issue, is there a lot. And I mean, looking at the research, all of these different categories, they are important if you want to understand what's going on.
So, in when you refer to makeup and these lifestyle questions, I guess that implies that in the Nordic countries, as in the US, the vast majority of influencers are female and the target audience is female. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you include in the concept of influencer, because that is a very sort of unclear concept for a lot of people. But yeah, I would say so.
Well,
I
that I have
usually
to
take
ask you.
this. Oh,
I have to ask
sorry.
you what your definition or understanding of influencer is then.
I usually point at three things that I think is, I mean, if you just talk about influencers, it's sort of in there in the name, someone who has some kind of influence, who can impact other people, but as we're talking about these social media influencers, I would say that it's like different from what you mentioned before, like this celebrity politics, for example, or celebrity, like the traditional celebrity is often someone who has become famous because of, like, I don't know, they can sing, or they can act, or they can do run fast or whatever. An influencer is most often famous for being famous, or and it's a fame built through and on in social media. You build your own brand on a social media platform. And the whole thing, the phenomenon, and the culture comes from even before what we call social media today. Before these platforms and so on, you had, the bloggers and the communities and so on, where people might would become sort of build this micro celebrity within a very maybe specific genre or community. So it's fame based on social media, or in through social media in some way, and that you sort of you cultivate your persona on your sort of your self brand in different ways, and then also cultivate, like, build this audience that you have a large following, that you also have some kind of more personal connection to. We usually talk about it as, parasocial relationships and so on, that you have some sort of dialogue, maybe on some level, depending on how big that audience is, of course. I mean, the biggest influences today probably have people employed to do that, answer the comments and moderate in the comment sections and so on. But yeah, so it's the social media and the sort of personal connection with your followers, but also something that I think is important in the definition is this the commercial side of it, that you also monetize the audience in some way. And that could be, only through banners and ad links and stuff like that, but also this maybe what influencers are most known for, the collaborations, doing sort of branded content for other brands and organizations or political parties, whatever. Or, writing books or whatever.
Whatever it may be.
Yeah,
And
you make money out of this in some way. And I think that's why I sometimes see people referring to people like I've heard people referring to Greta Thunberg, for example, as a social media influencer. And I think that's wrong, because in my world, she's a political activist using social media. But also other kinds of, I mean, the whole Friday for Future started as a very sort of offline protest, sitting on the streets, and they still do that today. So, and that commercial side of it is not there. Of course, you could say that she can make money out of who she has become and so on. But I've never seen her. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I've never seen her do like a commercial collaboration for with someone or for someone.
And this relates, this commercial aspect, I guess, to something you said earlier was important, which is class. Could you elaborate on that a wee bit, please?
Yeah, I think. I mean, of course, it's. Depending on what part of it you want me to elaborate on. But I think class is interesting here because since this, at least the genre of influencers that I've been looking at, they are working within this very sort of hyper commercialized environment. And it might be, you know, a lot of it circles around consumption, for example. And to do that, it's always, you know, it builds on like trying to present a lifestyle that is supposed to be both inspirational and also aspirational. And class comes into that because you often aspire upwards, you know. And at least for the ones that I've been studying, it's this sort of cultural middle upper class. So not really, you know, not the very, very, very rich, but still well-to-do, working with this kind of within an environment of free and creative, like socializing with other people in the arts and in journalism or in academia for that matter, you know, and so on. So it comes in there also. But I think it's also important to mention class because a lot of the sort of it's a researcher called her name is Brooke Erin Duffy. She's done a lot of work on influencers and influencer culture and like follow
One
it
of
from the start.
the podcast's earlier victims.
Oh, okay.
Well, sorry, survivors.
I really like her work because she points at this in her studies of influencer culture in the States, of course. But
Yeah,
I
her work
think
is
it's
great,
true.
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's true all over the world that it comes with these mythologies of that anyone can make it in this business if you just work hard, you know. You have to be creative. You have to work a lot and you have to be creative and you have to put yourself out there and you know, express your inner self in different ways and so on. But she shows that, yeah, it might be true for some people, but as in many other sort of creative lines of work, most people who make it, they have this. They come from a background of economic stability or, you know, middle upper class, where you have that opportunity to, you know, try and fail without too severe repercussions. And I think it's good to have that, you know, in the back of your head when you're looking at this, both as a researcher or as a, you know, someone who follows people on social media, that it's not as these opportunities are not equal for everyone. And it's not just about class and you know, the economy and so on. It's also about how these platforms work, that the technical affordances and the algorithm and all that does sort of highlight certain types of content that is often sort of in line with, you know, predominantly white, middle class, good looking and so on. So that also might make it hard for people who are not, you know, within those kind of within the lines of what's considered normal or whatever, to make it.
And Prof. Arneson, the last time we met was on a train,
Yeah.
and I think we shared maybe you had coffee, I had tea, but we were gossiping at a very profound intellectual level, of course.
Of course.
And one of the things you taught me about was this huge difference I've experienced since moving back to Europe from the United States, which is that many influencers here are actually already established celebrities. Take footballers, for example, and I've certainly seen that in Spain, that millions and millions of followers and categorized as influencers are people who play football for big European teams or did. Whereas in the US, they tend to be more people who are famous for being famous. But here there's a bit more overlap between the categories of people with a pre-existing fame and people whose fame derives specifically from social media.
Yeah, I think you're right, but it and that also is because of this sort of very floating definition of an influencer. That people today, well, the media tend to sort of categorize people as influencers if they do, you know, influencery things on social media. Which is not, I mean, to make money, I guess the big football stars or soccer stars of Europe, they don't, they make a lot of money anyways. But take the music business, for example. It's very hard to make money as a musician today because no one buys records. So you have to make money in other ways. And you might, which means that you go on tour and you have to have very spectacular shows and you have to charge a lot for entrance and so on. And for like up and coming artists, you have to, you know, you have to cultivate your presence on social media. You have to get known. You have to get maybe some kind of viral, like a viral it on TikTok or whatever. So you have to maybe use these tactics and strategies that we associate with influencers to brand yourself and to also then commercialize and monetize that work that you do and the following that you get. So I think that's why they are sort of overlapping a lot because we see the and that's true also in politics, for example, where we see political parties or political candidates or activists or whatever, you know, trying sometimes doing it well, sometimes failing, but testing out, would this work for us? You know, could we engage the audience this way? Could we influence them this way?
And I guess that leads me to a question about ethics, whether there is an ethical charter or manifesto that people sign up to, because it might be useful if I, as a person liable to be influenced, were told this product is being mentioned in this TikTok video because the person making the video was paid to do so.
It depends. I think there's like I talked about professionalization earlier, and that's the process of professionalization has, of course, you know, had an impact on this. That there are sort of, I wouldn't say there's a specific charter, but there are some sort of professional maybe standards and so on. Now I'm talking from a Swedish perspective because that's the context I know, and I know that there are. During the last couple of years, we've seen that there are different sort of organizations, almost, I wouldn't call them trade unions, but they are like Influencers of Sweden, for example, that is a professional organizational network for influencers that have these sort of ethical standards, for example. But there's also, I mean, there's the law. At least in Sweden, you're not allowed to do marketing without saying that this is paid promotion. So you have to, and this has been an ongoing discussion. There's been some court cases in Swedish influencers who have not, you know, made it clear enough for their audience that this is paid for, this is promotion. on Instagram, for example, and so on. And I guess the regulations look a bit different in different countries, but yeah.
Sweden is clear. Well, that
Yeah,
inevitably leads.
it's clear, but it's also very unclear because the regulation is says that if something is promotional, like advertising, then you have to tell the audience that this is advertising. And advertising is often, conceptualized as it's being paid for. You're paid by someone else to say something about a product or a service or whatever. But one of the strengths of influencer marketing is not just have an influencer saying something positive about your product in one or two paid Instagram posts. It's having that product inserted into this person's, everyday life and lifestyle. So it becomes something, it doesn't necessarily have to be a paid promotion. It's just something that the audience sees that this person, she or he uses this and it's in the background, it's on the shelf, and then become, okay, what is paid promotion? And so you have this, say you're paid to do three spots on three posts on Instagram about this, I don't know, shampoo. And then you continue having it in your social media content for 6 months after that. And then people know that, oh, this person, she uses this brand. Is that promotion then? Is that advertising or not?
And what do you do with product placement if you're making a James Bond film where there might be 30, 50, 60 product placements? The very end of the film, it'll list the companies involved, but everyone's left the theater or turned off the video by then. If you had to stop every time and saying, we saw James Bond swilling this beer because the company was paid X amount of dollars. This inevitably leads me to a piece you published fairly recently on Visit Dubai.
Yeah, could I just say one thing more about this? Because that's the commercial side of it. When as we were talking about politics earlier, and influencers who get involved in like doing promotion for political parties, for example, then it becomes even more. It's hard to say because then it becomes an issue of freedom of speech. Then you don't have to say that this is paid promotion because that falls under your personal freedom of speech, often. So then it might be even harder to actually point out or to make people aware that this is not just, engaging and fun content. This is actually a political message or paid for by some kind of political organization or so on. So yeah, sorry, I just wanted to add that because I
No,
think
thank
it's
you very much.
important.
That's very important. So I wanted to ask you about Visit Dubai because this is a campaign that you've written about in terms of a couple of Swedish influencers and controversies associated therewith. Could you share with us a little bit of what was going on with that piece you wrote and the issues associated with it?
Yeah, it was a couple of years back now that there was a campaign for sponsored by the state of Dubai then to get people to I just assumed that it wasn't just Sweden, but it was pretty popular in Sweden then, like 2019 around that time. Where they did these collaborations with some high-profile Swedish influencers who then got invited down to Dubai to, well, have a vacation there with their family and then post about it on social media. And that is one of the cases that I've studied as an example of this politicization, where the audience actually reacted to these collaborations and calling these influencers out, saying that why are you I think the title of the article is endorsing a dictatorship and getting away with it, which is actually a quote from the comment sections. That was basically the reaction from these critical followers, but also from the media. These collaborations and this campaign was also, you know, mentioned or criticized in the media, and Amnesty also criticized these influencers for doing these collaborations with the state of Dubai, based then on the politics of Dubai, you know, with the issues of freedom of speech and human rights and so on. So what I did, I studied this basically what was going on in the comment sections to these posts on Instagram and on these influencers' blogs, and trying to figure out, you know, what is this criticism about? How do people, again, it goes back to this issue of what is an influencer? What kind of responsibilities does an influencer have? And can in what way are they held accountable, and for what and why, you know? And it was, for me at least, I could see these followers who were very, very, very critical towards these influencers for doing these collaborations, but who were still, you know, fans. They weren't, you know, just haters coming in from outside and saying negative things about the influence. But these were people who said, like, expressed some sort of feelings of being disappointed because they had followed this person for a long time, and they thought they knew her. They thought they knew her values, you know, and who she was as a person. And then she does this, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't line up with the values, and it's not on brand for her. And they have could be very sort of like positive or understanding towards, you know, we know you have to make money, we know you have to do collaborations and so on, but why this, you know? And then you had the other ones who were more like, but why, she's just a person going on holiday. Why do you have to criticize her for this? Where you could see that this the commercial aspect of it wasn't as present. And it seems to be a difference there. If you understand these individuals, or, like, you know, media personas as brands, or as, you know, just a person who happens to have a following on social media, that has something to do with the conceptions about responsibilities, and also what kind of impact and political influence they might have.
And of course, because part of what they're selling is their legitimacy as a person and their personality, it's very hard to divide these things if you're an audience member or user or visitor. Very hard. Quick thing on the Emirates and associated places. About 10 years ago, I was approached by a major US private university to consider being a dean at their campus in the area. And was told as part of the preliminary conversation that if you're married, your wife will be able to walk around safely because if anybody were to steal her pocketbook, like purse, they would have their hand cut off. This was meant to be an appeal. On the Prof, I've got a couple final questions for you, and I'd like to pose them and then throw it back to you to conclude with anything we haven't discussed that you'd like. My first one relates to your study of this Visit Dubai controversy, and it's about how one learns about influencers. One method you use there is critical discourse analysis. So could you talk to us a bit about what you think are the best ways of comprehending this phenomenon?
I think you have to have a genuine interest. I mean, I'm trying at least to look at this from some sort of critical perspective, but I'm also genuinely interested in online culture, like so, and influencer culture, and this issues of authenticity and community and so on in online and in social media. So, and I think to understand it, you have to be in it for a long. It's like almost having some kind of doing some kind of ethnology or something like that. You have to be present on the platforms and follow these and different accounts or actors and see what's going on in the what the influencers are posting and what they're saying and so on. But also for me, at least, my biggest interest has been the audience and the comment sections. I've spent, I don't know how many hours, days, just scrolling through comment sections and following conversations and so on. And I think that's also, so I think you have to be sort of in it and learn about it and be genuinely interested, but still keep a critical eye on it, and maybe also coming from this critical discourse perspective, we have that. I think that's why I'm also been interested in the audience and the audience comments and so on, because we have a tendency to then look a lot at, the text and analyze the text and say that there are these, ideological implications here and so on. And maybe skip over the interpretations of the text and so on. And I mean, what I've done is still text because it's the comments. I haven't done interviews and so on with people, but it's at least an attempt to look at how is this received by the audience and what kind of different meanings, like the meaning making going on there, is what I've been trying to capture at least. Yeah, sorry, I don't know if I answered your
No,
question.
that's exactly what I was hoping to find out about, and that's great. So my last question before throwing to you to add anything you wish to is to ask what's next. And I do so as a spy who has read over your right shoulder the words Courtney Love on your whiteboard. Now, is Courtney involved in your next project? Is she a
She is.
co-author? Is she an influencer?
No, she's not
Is
a co. Oh, I
she
wish
a
she was.
waxworks museum object? What is Courtney's role?
Courtney, she's actually the object of study here. No, yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with influencers, actually. Because that is one of the downsides of this you have to be in it approach, that you also become sort of fed up after a while. And I've been doing this research for about 3 years now, so I am a bit fed up with the influencer part of it for now, at least. It will come back, and also maybe also because it's for me, I have a like an ongoing interest that's been with me for a long, long time. That is basically about this convergence of politics and promotion and consumption in different ways. And that's why I sort of got interested in influencers from the start. They were it's an interesting case for me. But yeah, no, the project that I'm actually working on, I was actually sitting here writing on an article just before this interview. It is about Courtney Love. It's for I'm working on a draft for a special issue of Rock Music Studies that are doing a special issue on Courtney Love and her music and her band Hole. Can't remember if it was in the call for papers, but it is in April is the 30th anniversary of the release of Live Through This, the big sort of hit album. So it has nothing to do with influencers, which is very satisfying for the moment. And it's also, I mean, it's a pet project for me, being a huge Hole and Courtney Love fan since I was a teenager.
When I lived in LA, I used to go and shop at the little tchotchke store or big tchotchke store in East LA that where her daughter worked. Very quiet, anonymous form. She doesn't seem to have the ego that her mother and father
No.
can have.
Hopefully not for her. I read that she has married the son of Tony Hawk,
God, I
the
still think Tony Hawk is a teenager running around on, empty swimming pools in the 1990s. So what do I know? Well, the children of the famous shall meet. So we're off to finish up. I wonder if there are things that we haven't discussed that you'd like to mention, or whether there are things we have touched on where you'd like to add a little more.
Not that I can think of now.
Well, in that case, you'll have to come back and talk about the Courtney Love special issue
Yes.
and other topics when
If the paper gets accepted.
and if not, we'll never discuss this again.
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, thank you so much, Professor Aronson. It's always lovely to talk to you. I always learn a lot from it, as I do from reading your work.
Thank you.